Hello, thank you everyone, and welcome to this week's speaker series. I'm very happy to be joined today by Patrick Kaufman. Patrick, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Amit. A pleasure to be here.
Patrick, so you're joining us all the way from Switzerland. Your company, Aquila Asset Management, that you have founded. Tell us a little bit about you, your firm, and then maybe we can jump into some of the strategies that you're managing.
Yes, we are a fixed income boutique based here in Switzerland, which we believe differentiates very much to our names. We are a bond picker. We are a pure bond picking firm. We have a bottom-up approach. We don't take into consideration any top-down decisions when we make investments, when we lend out money. So I think that's very important to mention, and this is what really differentiates us, I would say, to most of the standard fixed income manager who takes into account top-down decisions into the asset allocation.
Right. And that's a very good point, because most of the conversations with bond managers start and end with their view on duration. So your view on rates is you're kind of agnostic towards it. You're squarely focused on credit risk.
That's correct. And I have to say, we have something very beautiful in the fixed income space, and this is the roll down effect. So the roll down effect is a phenomenon which is very strong, and it helps us to not have to have a decision on rates. And so for us, the steeper the curve on a single issuer, the better for us and the longer we go. And the flatter the curve on a single issuer, the shorter will be our duration. And depending on the steepness of the curve, you can add 0.5% to 1.5% of additional return compared to the yield to maturity you buy when you sell this bond before maturity. And this is what we focus on. And we are totally agnostic to what rates are going to do.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about that, because I'm sure many, many investors, potential clients will want to understand, even though you're not factoring in duration considerations when you're making decisions, you are looking at the curves. How are you mitigating duration risk? Because duration risk exists whether you're discounting for it or not, or accounting for it or not. So how do you help mitigate that in your portfolio? Like, for example, maybe tell us a little bit about what you did in 2022 when shorter duration plays obviously did much better than longer ones.
Yes, we really don't implement it. It's really a function of the steepness of the curve on a single issuer on one hand. Plus, so we started in our main fund the year 2022 with a duration of above 5, which at the end for sure was painful. But interestingly, in 2022, we ended up the year almost in line with indices, depending which index you take on our flagship strategy, even better. So surprisingly, even not taking into consideration duration, at the end of the day, the result was pretty good. So at the end of the day, if you look back how market was positioned in terms of rates in September 2001, if you take the 10-year future treasury, non-speculative futures, the market was long. So at the end of the day, it's very difficult to time rates, to time the market and get it right. So we really want to avoid increasing or reducing the duration because we have a feeling that rates will go up or will go down. And again, steepness of the curve is key to us. Plus, on top of that, I would like to add that if we have an issue we like a lot, and this issue has a long-dated bond with a low cash price, we tend to favor such a long-dated bond. Why? Because the absolute risk will be lower for us. For us, the key is to not lose at least money possible in a restructuring. So the lower the cash price you can buy a bond, the less you get hurt in case you make an error in issue selection. So on top of that, even if we might know that rates go up, if we have an issuer we like and this issuer has a long-dated bond which might have a pickup on the yield curve plus a low cash price where we save 10, 15, 20 points, we're going to favor such a long-dated bond, because at the end of the day, in our strategy, key is to reduce the risk when you run into a restructuring. And the lower the cash price, the less you get hurt because the haircut goes over all bonds, and all bonds are pari passu normally.
So what percentage would you say generally of your holdings do go into restructurings? How prevalent is this a concern for you?
It depends on the years. I mean, that's key to reduce it the most possible. We don't have the exact number because it's very difficult to calculate, and there are many ways you want to calculate it. But I would say on average, it could be 1 to 2% on an average per year. But there are years where we have no
Sure.
restructurings, and then there are years where you have more. What I would say is there. Restructurings, our approach works very well. Our analysis works very well. The most problematic for us have been in these years we are managing this strategy is when it was fraud. Fraud was where we were hardest hit, and this is not possible to detect, unfortunately, because you have to rely on numbers when you take investment decisions, and therefore, starting to doubt on numbers would bias your investment approach, your investment philosophy, and this is something we cannot do. But I would say that was the hardest part where we were the most hit in the past.
I see. So walk us through your credit risk management process, and how do you decide where you want to take on credit risk? Because obviously it's such a key part of what your investment process is. I think many people are probably going to be asking, okay, so what's their competitive advantage? How are they able to basically generate almost all their alpha from bond picking?
Yes. So the key question in our work, on our daily work, is when we analyze an issuer, is going through the process of the credit analysis is to answer the question, are we getting enough compensation for the risk we are taking? And if we talk about risk, again, we talk about the risk of running into a restructuring and not the risk of the underlying volatility of that specific bond we are going to buy. So this drives our process, really trying to understand if we are getting enough yield for the risk we are taking. On a traditional corporate issuer, which represents roughly 85% of our portfolio, this is a two-pillar process. On one side, we are very much focused on analyzing the balance sheet, on trying to understand the fundamentals, and mainly trying to understand the capacity of deleveraging of such an issuer via cash flows. That's the first part, that's the first pillar. Second pillar, which for us is as important as the first pillar, is looking at the capital structure. And the more we are subordinated in the capital structure, the more we want a solid issuer in front, and the opposite. So if we have a first lien or collateral on some assets, even if the issuer is weak, but we understand that this collateral is enough to cover the bond, the money we are lending out, we are happy to take that risk. And as you are based in Miami, I always like to give the example of Carnival and Royal Caribbean. In April 2020, they came out with a first lien bond on their ships. Loan to value was slightly above 30% with 12 and a half coupon. So that was a great opportunity for us, which we bought into. But at that specific moment in time, we would not have lent on a senior unsecured basis to Carnival or Royal Caribbean because we had no idea how long the lockdowns are going to take to be lifted and travel going back to normal.
So because the bonds were partially collateralized with the ships, that's why you took the risk.
Yes, they were over collateralized. So loan to value was, Carnival put 12 billion of ships and the bond issuance was 4 billion. So the ships could have lost 70% in value and we would still have get 100% of our money back. And adding on top a 12 and a half coupon, we believe that was a favorable risk return for us. And then we took the decision to buy this bond into the portfolio.
Right. So, I mean, that's certainly, I mean, and that's a wonderful example But it's also a very atypical example because that came out of a one-off situation with the pandemic. How are you able to, or perhaps you're able to consistently source deals like that or arrive at trades like that? How do you do that in a normal environment where you don't have like a global pandemic forcing a company like Royal Caribbean or Carnival to collateralize parts of their ships as part of a bond offering?
The great thing about the fixed income market is, compared to the stock market, we believe there are many inefficiencies, many irrationalities in the fixed income market. So there is always an environment where something is not working properly, where the market is looking it at a different angle. And for us, the key is always to find out these names the market believes are riskier than we do. And then there is a normalization, typically rating upgrades, and then credit spreads tighten. For sure, in our approach, where we look for dislocations, where we look for irrationalities, March 2020, COVID time has been amazing to our approach. 2022 was a similar market environment. Everybody was trying to run out of the door. The door has a limited size, liquidity was limited, and many issuers got hit. And believe me or not, Ahmed, but we found issuers where the fundamentals were improving in 2022, but credit spreads widened by 300, 400, 500 basis points. So many things which made no sense, but this is where we go for. And if you look back at our track record, which now is over 10 years, we were able to outperform markets in a raising rate environment, in a lowering in lower rate environment. And we were ahead of benchmarks beginning of March 2020. But you can clearly see that we outperformed during or after COVID and after 2022, because the more dislocations, the more irrationalities, and the better you can make that in your favor for your investors as an active manager, as we are.
Okay, so I'd like to remind everyone that if you do have questions for Patrick, please submit them directly to the chat, or you can submit them to me directly on Teams or WhatsApp, and I'll gladly ask him. So, Patrick, let me ask you right now, how are you positioned? Give us an idea, a bit of an overview of how you're currently positioned right now in your portfolio.
Currently, if we take our main fund, the Solitaire Global Bond Fund, we have around one third, a little bit less than a third, is investment grade. The rest is high yield and not rated. Around 40% is emerging markets. Around 60% are developed markets with a bias towards Europe. There, I believe we differentiate us to many US dollar bond funds, which usually do have two third of North America and 30% of rest of the world. For us, it's much more diversified geographically and on a country level. Currently, our main strategy, the Solitaire Global Bond Fund, has a yield to maturity of close to 10%, so almost 600 basis points of spread. And here, Ahmed, still as you mentioned, in a normal environment, we have, in our opinion, not yet arrived to a normal environment. And we believe 2024 could be similar to 2021. 2020, many bonds rallied, and only in the second wave, some names we have in the portfolio start to rally. And if you look at our overperformance since beginning of the year, we've seen really idiosyncratic names which start to rally. The market became expensive. I mean, you know very well where credit spreads are currently. So for us, still having 600 basis points of spread in the strategy, looking at the fundamentals of our issues, we believe it makes no sense. So we believe the positioning really on that names which have not rallied yet should bring us a lot of future performance.
Okay. And let me ask you this. You mentioned one trade that you guys did, for example, that went very well. Would you care? You just mentioned Royal Caribbean and Carnival back in the throes of the pandemic. Can you maybe tell us a case where a trade you did not go so well, and how you got out of it, or what sort of walk us through the process of, because obviously not everything that you guys invest in is going to go well. That's part of it. So walk us through the process of how do you get out of bad trades?
Yes, there I can give you the example of really as mentioned before, fraud is a big issue for what was in the past a big issue, and that's really where we got most hurt. And I give you the example of Wirecard. I don't know if you guys in the US are aware of that company, but it was a German payment maker, which was actually in the DAX index. It was one of the 30 biggest German companies. And there were some allegations out from the Financial Times that numbers were not correct, that they are inflating revenues. So we went through the process. We looked at the company that was at the time, the straight bonds in euros were yielding around 7%. The converts with same maturity and same coupon were yielding 10%, pari passu, both with a much lower cash price. And we went through the numbers. We understood that this company has 2.5 billion of debt and 1.9 billion of cash. And on our conviction and our understanding is what an auditor really controls and knows it's really there is the cash. So buying this bond at 75 cents on the dollar, 2.5 billion of debt become 1.75 billion. In front of that, we had 1.9 billion of cash. So we thought at the 10 yield hedge back to dollars at that time of 3%, what was the hedging we were gaining? It was almost a 13% yield when we bought that name. We were thinking that this was very favorable in terms of risk return perspective. Nevertheless, at the end of the day, we realized that the only thing which was not correct was the cash, and the cash was not there. So at the end of the day, the only thing we got right in that name, Ahmed, is we bought the convertible, which is pari passu with the straight bond they had. The straight bond was an investment grade bond. And at the end, when the fraud came out, the scam came out, both bonds traded at the same cash price level.
Okay,
And
so right,
there,
yeah, okay.
so that's the only thing we got
Yeah.
right. And that, by the way, when we have a convertible from an issuer we like, which the option is worthless, but we get an additional yield, we are happy to take that, even though sometimes the convert is not rated, which was at that time the case of this Wirecard convert. So the only thing we got right there, but it was a top conviction. Maximum per issue, we don't go more than 3% of weight, and this was a 2% position, unfortunately, which cost us 1.6% of performance. But there is no visibility which comes out at the end of the day, so we decided to sell that position.
Got it. Understood. Understood. Okay, so let me jump now. It's almost 4:20. So let me jump to so a couple of questions that I've received here and that we're I'm seeing here in the chat. Someone's asking, what is the current duration and yield for the portfolio? I know you answered already the yield to maturity. Maybe you can go over some key metrics of the portfolio, especially of the flagship.
Absolutely. So the Solitaire Global Bond Fund has currently a duration of 4.8, an average rating of BB minus. The yield to maturity in dollar is 9.6% yield to maturity. And we have a current yield, so cash coming into the portfolio over the course of the next 12 months of 8.1%, which
Yeah.
whatever your scenario is, raising rate environment, lowering rate environment, you can make a little bit your math. But for sure, we have a nice cushion with a current yield of 8%, protecting us for whatever could happen
Yeah.
going forward.
Yeah, you'd probably have to have a at least an upwards of 100 basis points upward move in the Fed funds rate to cancel some of that. Some other key metrics. I know you mentioned the average rating is BB minus. Maybe give us the breakdown of what the current holdings are in terms of the strategy.
Yes, in terms of rating,
Yeah, rating.
again,
Yeah.
yeah, we for us in the process, if it's an investment grade rated issuer, a high yield rated issuer, or a not rated issuer, it's not important for us. Again, we need to answer the question, are we getting enough yield for the risk? And we can find names in the IG space where we answer favorable that question, and we can find names in the high yield space. By the way, we like a lot not traded, which currently represent around 10% of the portfolio, because we can do the work, we can analyze the issue, and if we get an additional yield because the issuer has no rating, we are happy to take that additional yield for our investors. And so around 30% is investment grade. Historically, it was in that range between 25 and 40% has been investment grade. Then always a very big part of the portfolio has BBB rated. We like a lot that space. The difference in terms of fundamentals between a triple B minus issuer and a double B plus issuer is not huge, but the yield difference can be high because there is a difference between investment grade and high yield. And then we have around 15 to 20%, if I'm not mistaken, of B names, and the rest is some Cs. And again, as mentioned before, 10% is not rated.
Right. And you mentioned before with Wirecard, for example, that you invested in the convertibles. Usually, tell us where in the capital structure are you invested other than the run-of-the-mill, bullets and term notes?
It all depends of the company we have in front of us. I cannot generalize. In some cases, we even buy the CoCo of a bank, so AT1 names. We believe this is equity risk, so we need an equity compensation. But whenever we have an equity compensation, we are happy to take that risk and be subordinated in the capital structure. And then there are some names we purely buy them because there is a collateral, there is a first lien, and then there are most of the parties is senior unsecured for sure, but we need to feel comfortable. And again, we cannot generalize, Ahmed, because in some cases you can be senior unsecured, but if you have a lot of bank debt above you, then you need to make your math in a different way. But what we like in general is if we are senior unsecured and it's the only debt of the company, then as well we like that a lot because the math is different, whereas if you have someone above you sitting in the capital structure. For example, to give you a concrete example, in April 2020, we bought an LNG terminal in Peru, and the bond was investment grade in February, and it was downgraded to high yield in March 2020. So the bond dropped from 100 to 40, and this is a $940 million bond, and it's the only debt in the capital structure. So at 40%, this 940 million becomes only 400 million. For sure, the numbers weren't looking good at that specific moment in time where we bought, but we understood if they have an issue, if they go into a restructuring, we will end up owning the terminal. So there is a different math you can make in such a
Sure.
situation. Whereas if you have a lot of debt sitting above you, the recovery values, if things go bad, can be much lower.
Okay. And then the final question here that I got was regarding ESG and ESG considerations and treatment of the fund. Care to expand on that?
Yes, sure. So there is this regulation in the UCITS regulation. Article 6 is you don't take any considerations. Then you have Article 8, light green, and Article 9 is impact investing. Both strategies are Article 8. We have some limitations that we have in terms of sectors. So we cannot buy gambling, weapons, and tobacco, as well as alcohol. And we have a limit constraint of 15% rated issuers below B in terms of ESG. But there, what I would like to mention is we are not a manager who doesn't buy some names because they have a bad ESG rating. It's a new dimension in the investment process we have implemented because nowadays a bad ESG issuer needs to pay an ESG premium. So we analyze that side, and if we see that we get an ESG premium and we understand that the issuer is working on improving its ESG rating, we are happy to take that ESG premium. Like if you buy a high yield issuer, which improves its credit rating. Nowadays, the ESG rating works in the same direction. And therefore, we are happy to buy a lower rated issue, which pays us an ESG premium and where we believe it's capable of improving that rating. And therefore, the ESG premium will lower. A concrete example we have in the portfolio where we believe there is a huge ESG premium is Pemex. We believe the difference between the sovereign Mexico and Pemex, 2 to 3% might be the credit risk, and the rest is ESG. Many fund managers cannot buy any more Pemex for different reasons, and this is why we believe the curve is trading so wide compared to the Mexican sovereign. But they have a strategy in place to improve their ESG rating until 2030. And we have seen that they have already started and it's bearing its fruits. So we believe there we can ride the wave. On one hand, the company is improving in terms of ESG, plus we're going to make capital gains because this ESG premium might narrow.
Right. Okay, great. Well, thank you so much, Patrick. Any sort of last words on the fund? I know it's a 5-star Morningstar rated fund, so congratulations on that. Maybe you can make a
Thank
few
you.
comments on that if you want. And any sort of last words you want to let our investors and financial advisors know before we
A
go?
pleasure. Yes, thanks a lot, Amit. We have had often in the history of the fund these 5 stars. We're very glad about that. We have won as well 3 times the Lipper Fund Awards. You can see them behind me in 2018, 2019, 2020. What I would like to say is our approach works not over a period of 6 months or 12 months. You need to have a longer horizon in the flagship strategy, 2 to 3 years. On the markets, we are passenger, but what we know, what we do is security selection, finding mispriced issues in the market, and in the fixed income space, the normalization comes sooner or later, in the worst case, at maturity. And in the meantime, you earn coupons. So therefore, nothing to say more about. I think that the track record is there, and we have still a lot of potential to recover. 2022 and 2023 have been very good years for us to reposition the portfolio to find a lot of mispriced issues, and we are looking forward to see a normalization on that credit spreads of that specific issues we have in the portfolio.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Patrick. Really appreciate you joining us all the way from Switzerland. I know it's pretty late over there for you. So Patrick Kaufmann, founder and portfolio manager at Aquila Asset Management. Patrick, again, thank you for joining us. We hope to speak to you again.
Thank you very much for having me, Amit. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. Likewise. Great evening.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Insignia Financial Group LLC comprises a number of operating businesses engaged in the offering of brokerage and advisory products and services in various jurisdictions, principally in Latin America. Brokerage products and services are offered through Insignia International Financial Services LLC, headquartered in Puerto Rico, and through Insignia Securities LLC, headquartered in Miami. Both are members of the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, FINRA, and Securities Investors Protection Corporation, SIPC. Investment advisory products and services are offered through Insignia Advisory Services LLC, an investment advisor registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission. In Uruguay, advisory services are offered through Insignia International Asesores de Inversión Uruguay, SA, Insignia Asesores de Inversión LATAM, SRL, and Insignia Asesores de Inversión de Uruguay, SRL, in Argentina, and through Insignia Argentina, SAU, and in Chile, through Insignia Asesorías Financieras, SPA. Collectively, these 8 operating businesses make up the Insignia Financial Group. To learn more about the broker-dealers, including their conflicts of interest and compensation practices, please go to https://insignia.com/disclosures/ or via www.finra.org. To learn about Insignia Advisory Services and any conflicts related to its advisory services, please see its Form ADV and brochure, which can be found at Investment Public Advisor Public Disclosures website, https://advisorinfo.sec.gov/.